This is Radio Silence.
Crimson flames tied through my ears, rolling high and mighty traps, pounced with fire on flaming roads, using ideas as my maps.
Let's begin by stating what I think we probably agree on. This is the greatest songwriter ever to write in English of any kind. This is including the Gershwins and Berlins, as well as everybody in pop music.
This is Radio Silence. I'm editor Dan Stone. Today we're talking with David Remnick about Bob Dylan.
His imagination is so fertile. His influence is so deep. His Americanness is so strange and rich and deeply intelligent that he is an unavoidable artist and has meant everything to me. So I get whatever I can get my hands on and try to wrap my mind around.
This past March, Radio Silence podcast host Benjamin Hedin sat down with David Remnick in the offices of The New Yorker. Benjamin, who wrote this program, is also the editor of an acclaimed collection of writings on Dylan called Studio A, The Bob Dylan Reader. Hedin's essays on music and literature have appeared in a number of publications, and he's currently finishing a novel titled The Price You Pay. David Remnick, our guest for today, has been the editor of The New Yorker since 1998 and is the author of several books. He began his career working nights on the police beat for The Washington Post. Later, he volunteered to work in the paper's Moscow office and was on hand to witness the fall of the Soviet Union. His depiction of that experience, Lenin's Tomb, won the Pulitzer in 1994. Since then, Remnick has published biographies of Muhammad Ali and Barack Obama, as well as two collections of profiles and essays. This work has all the immediacy and clarity of great reportage, which is to say, it makes the present intelligible. Yet Remnick's writing is also characterized by the wit, eloquence, and erudition we associate with the best essayists. He spoke with us about one of his favorite subjects, Bob Dylan, master American songwriter. Dylan turned 71 in May, but shows no sign of slowing down anytime soon. On tour for much of the year, he's reportedly at work on the second volume of his memoirs, and this September marks the release of Tempest, his 35th studio album. Here's host Benjamin Hedin with David Remnick.
Your introduction to Dylan, how and when did it happen?
You know, I was born in 1958. When I was a very little kid, I remember distinctly, I couldn't go to public school my first year soon enough. My parents wanted me out of the house and off to school, bright little kid, but, you know, missed the cutoff date. And so I would take this van to Paterson, New Jersey, to a yeshiva, a religious school, which I had no interest in being a religious school. I don't think my parents even did, but that's who would take me for kindergarten in 1963. And the older boys on the bus literally donned Beatle wigs and would sing Beatle songs in the bus, and pop music kind of came to you from the atmosphere.
These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days, these boots are gonna walk all over you.
But it wasn't until 1966 that I really registered, and I was a grand old 8 years old at this point, and a record came out, something called the Best of 66. It's one of those compilations that, you know, they were selling for $2.99 at EJ Corvettes. And I just looked it up for the first time, and on that album was Paul Revere and the Raiders and Chad and Jeremy and, you know, the new Christie Minstrels, that kind of stuff. And then there was this other thing. And I remember I'm 8 years old, not 18. There was this guy singing a song called I Want You. And it was so strange and electrifying, 8 years old. And I was hooked. I was absolutely hooked.
The guilty undertaker sighs, the lonesome organ grinder cries, the silver saxophones say I should refuse you. The cracked bells and washed out horns blow into my face with scorn, but it's not that way, I wasn't born to lose you. I want you. I want you, I want you so bad. Honey, I want you, drunken politician leaps upon the street where mother...
Dylan was the sun, and everything else was spokes on it, you know, to mix the metaphor of a wheel and a sun. So by being interested in Bob Dylan as a young kid, I heard weird words like Rambo and Verlaine and T.S. Eliot and Ezra Pound, things that I was completely incapable of understanding, but I'd go to church bookstores and buy these books and try to understand them and started to read. Same thing goes with the Beats. I didn't come to the Beats first in chronological order and then to Dylan. I came to the Beats because Bob Dylan, both in social terms and in artistic terms, was a relation of theirs. I saw pictures of Allen Ginsberg standing with Dylan and Philip Whalen and Lawrence Ferlinghetti. So, God knows, I had to be interested in that.
What poets do you dig?
Rambo, I guess. W.C. Fields. Allen Ginsberg.
I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked, dragging themselves through the Negro streets at dawn looking for an angry fix.
Angel-headed. So, as with love itself, there's no underestimating the importance of your first artistic love. It just becomes the hub of everything for maybe even too long.
You don't really think that, though, for too long. I mean, you don't think there's an age past which you should be expected to hold on?
No, I don't mean that I now reject it and think of it as childish things and I put it aside, anything but.
Dylan did make it permissible for songwriters to be bad beat poets, to write gibberish that sounds mighty profound but can't be paraphrased. I mean, when you hear a line like, "The geometry of innocence, flesh on the bone, causes Galileo's math book to get thrown," what do you hear?
I hear surrealism. I hear grabbing things out of beat poetry and ill-digested readings of Baudelaire and Rimbaud. I hear a young man struggling with his own reading and listening. Same thing in Gates of Eden. There are songs that are full of these things that that are surrealist images in the middle of nowhere, and they, even though they're not necessarily things that you can boil down to, and they're not crystalline, and they're not like reading Philip Larkin, where every word is clear as a bell. You don't want every poet to be Philip Larkin or Emily Dickinson. Without wildness, without going too far enough, art would be boring. And Dylan went too far enough a lot, especially early on.
Of course, over the past 50 years, it isn't just Dylan's music that has become iconic. The story of his life has evolved into a work of popular secular mythology. Nothing he does is evaluated on a human scale. We know the famous examples, playing electric rock and roll to a crowd of horrified folkies in Newport, Rhode Island, in the summer of 1965. I ain't gonna work on Maggie's farm no more. Crashing his motorcycle outside Woodstock the following year, after which he supposedly contemplated retirement. As with so many events in Dylan's life, it is difficult to separate legend from actuality. Dylan himself frequently blurred that line as a young man, lying or embroidering when asked about his background. In The Bridge, your book about Barack Obama, you wrote that Dylan's mind races to the mythopoetic.
The mythological dimension his life packs. Do you think that's why writers are so drawn to him?
Well, we're drawn to him for any number of reasons. We're drawn to him. Remember, I hate when we talk about him as a poet, as if it's not enough to say he's a songwriter and a performer. There's music there. His music may not be Mozart, but it's the music that's adequate to the job. The mythopoetic component in Dylan, what's interesting about him is that it's both in the work and in his way of projecting his life. Not necessarily the life as it's lived from day to day, but the way he projected it, which was a very big concern of his from the start. and the music is often even extraordinarily inventive and beautiful on its own terms. A song like Blind Willie McTell, this is as beautiful an American song as has ever been written for the stage, for the screen, for Frank Sinatra, for anybody.
Seen the arrow on the doorpost, saying this land is condemned, all the way from New Orleans to Jerusalem. I traveled through East Texas, where many martyrs fell. And I know no one can sing the blues like Blind Willie McTell.
What makes Dylan elusive and mysterious is this highly, highly ironicized public image. Think of the early press conferences. Think of interviews again and again and again. Dylan, right out of the gate, was a master at not only his self-creation, but his own bullshit.
Welcome to the first KQED Poets Conference. Press conference. Mr. Dylan is a poet. He will answer questions about everything from atomic science to riddles and rhymes. Go. Do you think of yourself primarily as a singer or as a poet?
Well, I think of myself more as a song and dance man, you know.
I mean, his telling of tall tales about himself, that he would tell interviewers that he had been a hustler, you know, a male hustler, and that his parents had turned their backs on him. And in fact, his parents were incredibly conventional, loving parents of a sort, and the only male hustling he ever did was to get a record contract. He was a very ambitious guy. No less ambitious than Titans of the Law. He wanted to live a huge life, huge artistic life, but also a big life.
Do you think you'll stick with folk rock, or are you going on into more writing?
I don't play folk rock.
What would you call your music?
I would call it I like to think of it more in terms of vision music. It's mathematical music.
Would you say that the words were more important than the music?
The words are just as important as the music. There would be no music without the words.
It's interesting to me to read interviews, whether the interviews themselves are crystalline or not, or clear or not, that Dylan knows himself in the sense that he knew that at a certain time of his life, particularly from his mid-20s, for about 5 years, he was possessed. The stuff was tumbling out of him. For whatever literary, physiological, mysterious reason, the stuff was tumbling out of him. He describes writing the songs on Blonde at a table, just typing lyric after lyric after lyric. And it's so uncontained that it becomes a double album. And this will never happen again. And this is a very common thing to hear about artists, that there is that period of possession.
Ain't it just like the night to play tricks when you're trying to be so quiet? We'll sit here stranded, but we're all doing our best to deny it.
And then afterwards, they mature and certain they bring other things to their work that may be even better in some ways. But they're never possessed in quite the same frenzied, hysterical way. The velocity is no longer there. It's almost athletic. That's the case with any number of artists. You can never sustain that forever, and it's why also there are periods that he struggled. The interesting thing to read in Chronicles is the period not only of coming to New York and becoming himself, which is, of course, the signal moment of American self-creation, but and then in the 80s where he's a mess, where he's in a creative trough and he can't quite get out of it, even though in every one of those so-called bad albums there's a song of real genius. Empire Burlesque has Dark Eyes. I'd buy any album with Dark Eyes on it.
Oh, the gentlemen are talking, and the midnight moon is on the riverside.
You're listening to Radio Silence with Benjamin Hedin. He's talking today with the New Yorker's David Remnick about Bob Dylan.
It's time for me to slide. I live in another world, but life and death are memorized, where the earth is strung with lover's pearls, and all I see are dark.
A bullet from the back of a bush took Medgar Evers' blood. A finger fired the trigger to his name.
As a young man, Dylan was a darling of the left and embraced political subjects in his writing. The song you are listening to, Only a Pawn in Their Game, was written following the assassination of Medgar Evers in June of 1963. But in the middle of the 1960s, Dylan stopped writing political songs and has since refused, with one or two exceptions, to be identified as a spokesperson. I have taught Dylan to students of all ages, and whenever we discuss the 60s and his decision to turn away from the turbulence of that era, I will ask them whether or not art should be political. Most will answer yes.
Do you agree? Do you think that it needs to have some kind of reformist, or even, if not that, moral intention?
I think these are people who are answering the question who are not themselves artists, who are not themselves writers. Writing is about freedom. And once there are artificial shoulds imposed on everyone, you're no longer in the realm of art, you're in the realm of propaganda. And I think it's absurd in a world that is infinitely more complex and at times interior that there should be an insistence that everything is political. What transpires between a man and a woman, or a man and a man, or a woman and a woman, or a man and the universe, need not be about tax policy or issues of war and peace. I think what Dylan was bucking against was the word should, the requirement. He should be able to do what he wants. If what's on his mind is his inability to connect with a woman, then the songs that come out of that, as in, well, Blood on the Tracks, it's the so-called divorce album, that's what weighed on him. Why shouldn't he do that? What was the result? An incredible work of art. So this business about what should be is preposterous. I took the same courses. I read the same books. Everything is political. Bullshit. Everything is not political.
Buckets of rain, buckets of tears, got all them buckets coming out of my ears, buckets of moonbeams in my hand. You got all the love, honey, baby, I can stand.
Reinvention is the order of the day with Dylan, right? And that makes him probably one of the great characters, not just in American music history, but all American history.
After getting finished with Russia and coming home, I wanted to write something very, very American. And I wanted to write something, quite frankly, in a narrative sense, much simpler. And so I wrote a book about Muhammad Ali. Not the whole story, but rather his becoming, his self-creation. And the more I both researched how this kid, Cassius Clay, created this thing called Muhammad Ali, out of all the various strands and influences in the air, professional wrestling, the Nation of Islam, Gorgeous George, Sam Cooke, and made himself what he was.
The heavyweight champion of the world, Muhammad Ali. You've never seen a man in history move like this. Notice that. Ain't that beautiful? Dodging all of those powerful punches. You notice him floating like a butterfly and stinging like a bee. That's my old saying.
The more I became convinced, and I'm sure I'm only the last to think of this, that this is a distinctly American activity. So a Jew from the Iron Range who had a bar mitzvah and played in a talent show, creating a thing called Bob Dylan with a funny voice that's made up of influences that range from Gene Vincent to Elvis Presley to Woody Guthrie, and he talks with a Dust Bowl accent. Look, you're from Minnesota, I'm not. That accent, which he internalizes, which becomes his voice, this is part of the serio-comic American habit. Annie Oakley wasn't Annie Oakley when she was a kid. Even Bruce Springsteen is not Bruce Springsteen when he's a kid. He's a lonely, geeky, music-obsessed adolescent. Gorgeous George, believe me, was not Gorgeous George. It happens over and over and over again. It's why hip-hop artists give themselves new names.
But it isn't just willed into being, right? I mean, we also, to a degree, desire the legend or create the myth. Like the motorcycle accident, he just had a bruised back. We make it into the, you know, and we make it into this.
Right. We required a reason why he went missing, and spending more time with your children is too banal, or with your wife in Woodstock, or recharging your batteries creatively, whatever those confluence of reasons were for his relatively brief withdrawal, but in the supercharged 60s, it seemed like forever.
Dylan's faith has been a constant source of speculation to his fans and biographers. Raised Jewish, he converted to Christianity in his 30s, and his songs are soaked, of course, with religious poetic imagery. Around the appearance of Time Out of Mind in 1997, he told Newsweek magazine, "Here's the thing with me and the religious thing. This is the flat-out truth. I find the religiosity and the philosophy in the music. I don't find it anywhere else. Songs like Let Me Rest on a Peaceful Mountain or I Saw the Light, that's my religion. I don't adhere to rabbis, preachers, evangelists, all of that. I've learned more from the songs than I've learned from any of this kind of entity. The songs are my lexicon. I believe the songs."
When you get to those albums like Love and Theft in Modern Times, what's most rewarding?
It's not just the tackling and embracing of an older man's themes, facing the end and all the obvious lyrical themes, but it's also the even greater inclusion of musical forms so that somehow Dylan is now completely out of time, enmeshed in American musical forms that he started listening to on Harry Smith's or on God knows what other albums he was borrowing and stealing from his friends in Minnesota during his brief college career or when he first got to New York. He's out of time. When you listen to him, whether it's something that came out in 5 years ago or 25 years ago, nothing feels old.
I got a craving love for blazing speed, got a hopped up Mustang Ford, jump into the wagon, love, throw your panties overboard. I can write you poems, make a strong man lose his mind. I'm no pig without a wig, I hope you treat me kind. Things are breaking up out there.
Whereas if you listen even to the Stones, there's a datedness to the kind of threat, for example. It's funny now, right? It just dates. This notion of rock and roll as dangerous. They've become their own tribute band. They haven't come up with a new song in a quarter century, in a generation. Creatively, it's very stuck in time. Dylan is not any more stuck in time than going to hear Lightning Hopkins or Verdi.
Well, earlier, talking about the lyrics, it was going too far and taking risks. But what you find in the late songs is a kind of bleak clarity that is really powerful. You know, in Highlands, every day's the same thing at the door. Feel farther away than ever before. Some things in life, it just gets too late to learn. That, too, is quintessentially artistic, right? Most begin with opacity and work towards clarity. Auden, for example. Do you see that kind of pushing through as an integral part of Dylan's late greatness?
You know, some people start with opacity and end with opacity, and they remain interesting all the way. John Ashbery is one, a kind of insistence on the enigmatic. So I don't know that that's necessarily the pattern of artistic development. What's clear and natural there is that when you're 25... you may know death is intellectually looming 60 years on or something like that, or if you drive too fast or smoke too much. When you're Bob Dylan's age, the evidence is all around you. You know, you've already had a near fatal heart disease. You've had any number of friends die, and not just of drug overdoses, but of natural causes. And it's coming like Christmas, and that weighs on all those albums. On all those albums, it is the big weight, as it should be. It's the most enraging vision right in front of your face all the time at a certain age.
Well, my heart's in the Highlands, gentle and fair, honeysuckle blooming in the wildwood air.
Let's go back to what we were talking about before. Most artists, most writers, and I see this in my role as an editor, dealing with talented people, no one stays the same from the age 25 to age 80. Their artistic powers wax and wane. And the most common pattern, even with an extremely talented songwriter, performer, painter, what have you, is to have a moment, 10 years, 15 years. Any artist that's struck by lightning in that 10, 15 year period is very fortunate. Bob Dylan is freakish in the sense that he starts when he's 20 years old, and a half century later, we're really interested to see what the next album is going to be. To say nothing of his touring life, the painting, the writing of a memoir, which is shockingly good. Shockingly good. That doesn't happen very often. Philip Roth is an exception. Verdi is an exception. Rembrandt. People who have these late period efflorescence, and to see it in pop music, which we generally think of as a young person's form, just gives you an indication of how rich the work is for him.
Wouldn't know the difference between a real blonde and a fake. Feel like a prisoner in a world of mystery. I wish someone would come and push back the clock for me.
What's great about Bob Dylan is not that he comes along and plays in the narrow groove of his first album, where he's imitating Woody Guthrie or Dave Van Ronk or Cisco Houston or any of those people. It's what he does next and next and next and next. That's the rarity of the body of work, is that it develops, it builds, it goes off into crazy corners.
I'm listening to Neil Young. I gotta turn up the sound. Someone's always yelling, turn it down. Feel like I'm drifting, drifting from scene to scene.
David, thank you very much.
My great pleasure. I enjoy talking about nothing more than Bob Dylan. Thanks.
I'm wandering the world in a devil kit at all. Possibly me.
Thanks for listening to Radio Silence. Today's program was written by Benjamin Hedin and produced by Adam Campy. You heard an excerpt from These Boots Are Made for Walking, which was written by Lee Hazelwood and covered by the New Christy Minstrels on their album New Kick. The New Christy Minstrels sing the hits of today and tomorrow. Song excerpts written and performed by Bob Dylan were used by permission of Special Rider Music. They include My Back Pages from Another Side of Bob Dylan, I Want You from Blonde on Blonde, Maggie's Farm from the Bootleg Series Volume 7, Blind Willie McTell from the Bootleg Series Volumes 1 through 3, Tombstone Blues from Highway 61 Revisited, Dark Eyes from Empire Burlesque, Only a Pawn in Their Game from The Times They Are a-Changin', Buckets of Rain from Blood on the Tracks, Visions of Johanna from Blonde on Blonde, Things Have Changed from The Essential Bob Dylan, High Water for Charlie Patton from Love and Theft, Highlands from Time Out of Mind, and Peggy Day, which you can hear below, from Nashville Skyline. Our thanks to David Remnick, Jeff Rosen, and of course, Mr. Dylan.
Peggy Day stole my poor heart away. By golly, what more can I say? Love to spend the night with Peggy Day. Love to spend the night with Peggy Day.
This is Radio Silence.